controversy over the death penalty, the child protection system, and more. It's all part of the tragic tale of the murder of a priest in St. Augustine. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show video on demand with our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, a look at the story behind the murder of Father Rene Robert. Get on the line now with your questions at 549-2937. Then later, our book club spotlights the work of a genius, not a writer, but an editor, the late Maxwell Perkins. Our book club leader, Stacy Goldring, will tell you his story. Plus, find out about the unique exhibit this month at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Jacksonville. All of that ahead. But first this hour, a Georgia prosecutor is seeking the death penalty in the murder of a local priest. 71-year-old Father Rene Robert of St. Augustine was killed in April up in Burke County, Georgia. A deeply troubled young man, 28-year-old Stephen Murray, has already confessed to the crime. Now, there are a lot of tentacles to the story, one of them being that Robert was a priest firmly opposed to the death penalty. So much so that he signed a document called a Declaration of Life, stating that if he should ever himself be murdered, he did not want to see his killer put to death. But that is just one of the issues around this high-profile murder case. Florida Times Union investigative reporter Eileen Kelly has been covering this story, and she joins us now in studio. Eileen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And what are your thoughts and questions about the murder of Father Rene Robert of St. Augustine? We'll go to the phones in a little bit. The number to call in is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/First Coast Connect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on Facebook. Let's go back to the beginning. Father Rene Robert, who died in April, was a priest who was doing prison ministry, among other things. And that's where the story sort of began, isn't it?
It is. He was very, very passionate about what he called injustices. When people got out of jail and had nowhere to turn, it really touched his heart. And he tried to rally as many people around him as he could to help people, saying, you know, they have done their sentence, we have to help them. We need to help rehabilitate them. They are a part of society, and they deserve to be loved and treated with dignity and fairness. And I spoke to a number of his friends that said that he was just very, very brokenhearted about people that have been cast away in society.
Right. And one of them was a young man named Stephen Murray. And so Father Robert met Stephen Murray in the course of this ministerial work, yes?
Yes, he did. Father Robert had been helping Stephen's girlfriend, who is a heroin addict, and had been trying to help her for about the past 10 years, her mother told me. And he and Stephen and Ashley started dating about in the fall, and that's how they were introduced to Father Rene.
We'll go to your calls for reporter Eileen Kelly at 549-2937 in just a moment. And you've covered in the Times Union in depth the course of events that led to Father Robert's murder. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what exactly happened the night he was killed?
Well, from what I understand from talking with Stephen multiple times was on April 10th, he was running out of options. He had been released from jail on April 6th. His sister didn't want anything to do with him. His girlfriend was now in prison. He moved back in with his father, and it's his father that Stephen blames for much of the problems in his life. And he just didn't want to be there anymore. Mm-hmm. And he had been calling on Father Rene for help, and Father Rene had started to say no. And that is because Stephen's sister had contacted the priest when her brother was in jail. It was just a brief lockup, and said, please don't help my brother anymore. I'm very concerned about his mental health. I think he's doing heroin, and please do not give him money because I know that it will go for drugs. And so Stephen did begin calling him, and he said the priest just kept saying, no, no, no. And then for reasons that I'm not quite sure of, the priest finally did say yes. When Stephen told him that someone owed him money. And so he came up to Jacksonville and picked him up.
And they went up to South Carolina together.
They did.
And that ended with the priest being shot.
Yes.
Now, the other thread to the story that you've exposed so powerfully is that Stephen and all of his siblings alleged that they were sexually abused by their father. Can you talk a little bit about that piece of it?
They do. This is kind of how I first came into the story, wanting to really try and chase this story down. I made a phone call very early on in April up to someone that I didn't know, but I found a phone number from one of the 911 reports. And this woman had said, you know, if you dig deep enough into this family, you're going to be very troubled by what you find. There's incest, there's rape, there's drug abuse from all of the children and the father. And it's just a very tragic story. And you're not going to believe what, you know, what we know up here in Aiken, South Carolina, to mm-hmm. be true. And it just started, you know, happening that finally I get through to the family, and they start telling me, the sisters start telling me about the lives that they lived as well as their brother. They signed some waivers that allowed me to get all of their Department of Social Service records. Completely unredacted. They wanted them turned over to me, which in my 25 years as a journalist has never happened. It's the access to these records were pretty unprecedented and quite troubling when you read about.
You found a nightmarish picture.
Yes.
A father that all of the siblings allege beat and molested his children for years.
Yes.
And the child service system in Georgia. Tell us about that.
Well, they had been monitoring this family, sometimes weekly, for years and years, because it's my understanding that it started with the children showing up to school covered in bruises, and then they would go and live with an aunt. And then the record, but those records, I believe, have already been destroyed. The state doesn't have to keep records older than 10 years old, although we did get some that were closer to 10 years old. And but the records that I got start with Stephen's sisters when, you know, they're telling school teachers, pastors' wives, writing down, documenting what they say their father was doing to them. And then I had police reports that also, the case files, they were released to me as well, that showed, you know, what police were doing and trying to do. But as with all the cases, the girls, Stephen's sisters, you know, while the police were in the middle of investigating, would then go to the police and say, I lied. And, you know, I didn't mean it. And then the police side would stop, but the Department of Social Service would not. And the Department of Social Service records do suggest that they felt that the girls were being threatened. And from police officers that have spoken to do believe that that abuse did occur.
We'll go to your calls for reporter Eileen Kelly of the Florida Times-Union in just a moment at 549-2937 as we discuss her investigation into the murder of St. Augustine Catholic priest Father René Robert. I think what your reporting has revealed is that, of course, the background of Stephen Murray and his family doesn't excuse his violent acts, but it provides some context to explain them.
Absolutely. You know, Father Robert he never should have died. There's no question about it. What the suffering that he must have gone through is chilling. But what I believe that we did with The Road to a Killing was to look into the mind of a killer, into his life. And it's relatively easy to hate someone when you don't know them, when you don't have a name associated with them, when you just have an inmate number, which is pretty much what the lives of prisoners is anyway. But then when you start looking at records, I mean, you know, even though these were his sister's records, there was quite a bit about Stephen because they were monitoring the whole family. And it's
monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
But these children were returned to their father over and over again.
They were.
Do you fault the Georgia child welfare system?
I think it was a combination of things. I think it was also family, that other people were not stepping in and saying, no, this, you know, we have to stop this. I spoke with the Stephen's mother, who is now deceased. I spoke with her sister, and she tried over and over to get her sister to leave the husband, but she didn't until the kids were already grown. And, you know, as a police officer said in this report, by the time they started hearing the stories of abuse, the damage had already been done. You know, I think it's a combination of things.
The other piece to this story that's so fascinating is that prosecutors in Georgia will seek the death penalty for Stephen Murray, even though the priest, Father Robert, had actually signed a document stating that he was so opposed to the death penalty that if he should, God forbid, die of a violent crime, he did not want his killer to be put to death.
I know, it's
fascinating. How about that?
That is chilling, too.
I didn't even know there was such a document one could sign, but it's called a Declaration of Life.
Yes. Yes. Some nuns up in New York started what's called Cherish the Life Circle in the mid-90s when a governor was running for office and vowed to bring back the death penalty. And so it was signed primarily by priests and nuns. Mario Cuomo did sign it, and within a few years, about 1,200 people had signed it. And the diocese down here in St. Augustine came across that document after Father Robert was killed, and it was in his personnel file. And so they said that they are vowed to continue with his wishes and to try and get the prosecutor to understand that this man truly despised the death penalty and to not do it in his name.
And that carries no legal weight.
No, it doesn't.
But as we continue to look at all of the complexities of this story, reporter Eileen Kelly's investigative report on the death of Father Rene Robert, The Road to a Killing, we want your calls. We'll go to the phones right now at 549-2937. John in Atlantic Beach is with us. Hey, John, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, and thanks also for the incredible research you've done on the story. What has struck me are the comments on social media that are almost unanimous in that, you know, his background doesn't matter. He's a horrible person. He deserves to die, all that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering if either of you have an opinion about whether this is just sort of the prerequisite, you know, dehumanizing someone you want to have killed, or is it, you know, ignorance as to the extraordinary effect our upbringing has on our later life, or, you know, any thoughts on that would help. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, John.
Well, as I was saying earlier, I do think that it's easier for people to not want to know someone's background and to not want to, you know, put a face, put a heart, put anything to a killer. And, you know, I understand, you know, why people are saying what they do, but when you do look inside the deeply troubled life of this young man, you know, it's really hard not to say that he didn't stand a chance either. I mean, what he did was unconscionable. Father Robert never should have been killed. But it's, you know, when you look inside the life of a killer, I'm sure that there's plenty of other people on death row that also have similar stories of abuse, and particularly with men, I think that they have a harder time with the whole sexual abuse aspect. I was talking to a psychiatrist
yesterday.
This
man's sisters were abused too, but mm-hmm. they've been able to sort of rebuild their lives.
They have, and they said that their brothers were never able to come to terms with it.
Why, and you spoke to a psychiatrist about this, why the shame of child sexual abuse for a boy child.
Exactly.
Has an even more devastating impact.
Absolutely.
Than it might for a girl child. Why is that?
I think because girls are more likely to talk about the problems, and you're more likely to, you know, wrap your arms around a little girl and say it's okay to cry, whereas boys are raised a little bit differently. And you know, men do try and control things a little bit differently than women do. And then obviously you have that, you know, the idea of, you know, oh, does this make me gay now if you're not, you know?
There's a whole basket of issues.
Sure. Yeah. And this man that I was speaking to yesterday was actually a psychiatrist out here in Duval County in the jails. And he said that there are a number of people just like Stephen that are incredibly troubled because of sexual abuse. And, you know, the suffering is just, it's that, you know, they act out, you know, in rage, and, you know, their lives are, they pretty much lost control of their lives.
Anecdotally, doesn't the data show, too, that girls who've suffered in this way are more likely to self-harm, boys are more likely to act out, sometimes violently, against others?
I believe so, yes. Yeah. And these, and, you know, his sisters did go on and abused drugs for quite some time. His oldest sister stopped with the crack use when she told herself she had to forgive her father. And I think that that was her only way to come clean, because the more she hated her father, the more she was doing crack. Stephen's little sister still hasn't forgiven her father and actually will not call him daddy. She calls him by his name. And she has a long road to recovery as well.
549-2937. Bill is in Clay County. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, good morning, Melissa. Good morning to your guests. You know, what your guests are saying is true. If you work in dependency, you find out that kids that suffer abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, they run into all types of, they acquire all types of psychosis or psychological problems. And if it's not corrected, we know that the young person's minds don't really develop fully until they're about 20, 21 years old. If they focus on certain negative things for a period of 10 or 12 years through their young adulthood, you can see where that can lead to them committing, you know, horrendous crimes. If you work with people on death row, which I do, we have a lot of brothers, when you talk to them, they inadvertently bring out their childhood. And in most cases, there's a case here where there's some sort of abuse or there's some negative in terms of their family. And you can see where, because through their life they didn't get any help, they eventually developed traits that lead them to doing violent things. So the point I'm trying to bring out is when we bring young people into the criminal courts, for whatever reason, I think that's a time for us to say, hey, let's try to get an idea from a psychological standpoint where this child is like, is about, find out what his environment is like. So we have some understanding so we can work to see if there's something that we can do to intervene at this early age. Because if these things aren't corrected at an early age, and the statistics from foster care bear out the fact that, you know, kids that aren't, that don't have this correction and ongoing counseling and good parental advice and someone to really look after them, that the outcomes for them are extremely poor. So I think basically what I'm saying is that I think in the criminal justice system, when young people come into that system, whether it's through dependency or a criminal issue, we should look at doing some serious things in terms of evaluation and analysis of their home and environment to see if we can put together some sort of intervention. Because we know if we don't, the outcome for these kids and the statistics prove it.
Yeah, thanks,
not
Bill.
Not necessarily that great.
Thanks, Bill. Eileen.
Yeah, thank you. This is a great caller. Yeah, from what Stephen told me and his sisters told me, it was at age 11 that Stephen was first locked up, and that he would do a lot of minor crimes and basically just wait for the police to take him away.
He wanted to be taken out of the house.
He did.
And as Bill, the caller, pointed out, if a young child is abused physically, emotionally, sexually, it does warp their brain development.
Of course,
there's
it does.
A wealth of data to support that.
Mm-hmm.
This killer, Stephen Murray, he somehow made it all the way to the 11th grade, but he was basically operating at a third grade level, you reported.
Yes. Yeah. They could not kick him out of school. He was labeled severely emotionally disabled. And so, pretty much, I mean, they'd kick him out of school, you know, for suspensions and things like that. He was tailed at school by someone he called the Shadow. A cop that I spoke with also spoke about that, because they just didn't trust him. the police officer, Vicki Gaskins, said she was not personally afraid of him, but she was afraid for the school. She worried about another Columbine, that he was very explosive.
Uh-huh.
And from everything that I can see and through the documents that I've read, I mean, he was a child that never even understood love at all.
Yeah, let's see. Let's go to Peter on the south side. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, hi. A couple of comments. One is that the Roman Catholic Church, as I understand it, has an official position against the death penalty. Secondly, it seems that there was a failure in South Carolina of the child protection system because his sisters did complain to the police, but there was no prosecution or anything of the father. Thirdly, much as I admire Father Rene Robert, it does seem, based on the reporting in the Times Union, that he was basically being used. He was aiding and abetting, basically, those people. Those are my comments.
Okay.
I think that there was a certain sense of naivete with Father Robert, and Stephen admits that his girlfriend, you know, called him a pushover, and, you know, junkies, they look at just getting their next fix.
And you think he was maybe an easy mark?
Yes.
Sadly, this priest?
Yes.
Very sad to read that.
Even the sheriff down in St. Johns County said the same thing, and he was friends with Father Robert, and he said he would warn him about the people that he was ministering to, saying, you know, I know that you believe in redemption and you believe that all humans deserve compassion, but sometimes a con is always going to be a con, and people will do anything. They'll say anything to get money for their next fix.
Lots of comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Anne writes, what can be any worse than this story? Abominable. Tina, thank you for the in-depth coverage and interviews around this case. Wiles writes, this sad story parallels the bigger picture of our fear-driven society. The recent highlight of murderous events all across the country displays fear. Police afraid of citizens that they killed, and those killing innocents in nightclubs or at peaceful events. Please address the fear-driven motives. There's been so much violence in this country in the last week, it truly is heartbreaking.
I couldn't agree with you more. We are a very violent society, and that even goes to, you know, on social media, some of the people's reactions to this story.
How are they reacting?
In terms of, such as what the caller from Atlantic Beach said, you know, I don't want to read this, put him to death.
Mm-hmm.
And Father Robert was the opposite of this in terms of, he did not believe in violence. He was a Franciscan. He did not believe in having any worldly possessions, and not that he had any. You know, in retirement, he made probably no more than $24,000 a year, and he gave away all his money. But yeah, society is very violent, and people do things half-cocked, and they fly off in rages, and, you know, Stephen did that, and there will be other Stephen Murrays out there, unfortunately.
Let's take one more call. It's Tom on the west side. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, good morning. I'm of two minds on this. I generally deplore the death penalty, but I always have trouble in cases where the crime takes place over a good length of time, in which case the accused has time to rethink his actions and maybe step away. So in this case, it sounds like the gentleman in question may not have had that capability. I think the bigger problem here is this man was so well known for all his problems and had been through the system so many times and yet never received any appropriate help. I think that is the real cause of this tragedy.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And here's a tweet for you, Eileen, from a listener saying much the same. Sexual abuse, physical abuse, mental illness, they are common on death row. Had someone helped them, they likely wouldn't have killed. Is there anything that you think child welfare officials could have done that they didn't do that might have prevented this tragedy?
I think that they probably could have pulled the children aside much more than, The documents that I have, you know, say that, oh, Stephen was cleaning the yard, and, you know, it was just kind of a slight snapshot, but there was thousands and thousands of them, but not, you know, not the caseworkers' individual interactions with the children. In terms of, you know, they were just looking like, okay, there's food in the refrigerator, the house is neat, the kids are dressed appropriately, but that's not the problem. I mean, that's not the allegation for if the kids were being fed or not, and if the house was neat. That's
should they have just permanently removed the children?
Yes.
To me, that is the larger question, because, of course, the impetus is usually to keep families unified.
It is.
Are there cases in which that simply is not a good idea, and was this one of them?
I believe so, but they only can go as far as regulations and laws allow them to.
Is that the next piece of this story?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, it's excellent reporting,
and I
thank you so much for sharing it with us. She's investigative journalist Eileen Kelly. The Road to a Killing is in the Florida Times Union and on Jacksonville.com. And we'll be right back.
A young American is working in Ethiopia when he's attacked and his computer is stolen. Months later, he gets a message from the new owner of that stolen laptop, and the messages keep coming.
What is our obligation to one another, having come into contact in such a bizarre way?
More about the risks and the surprising potential of keeping up that contact. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next episode of Hometown, Beth Sullivan, a.k.a. Mermaid Coral Beth, is a professional mermaid who teaches kids to use their talents to positively impact the lives of others. Jacksonville-based clothing designer Sally Kaiser shares the story of her mobile fashion truck-turned-brand, Sally Ann. Local entrepreneur Gwen Mims Minter shares the journey of her namesake salon, Gwen Mims. And Christina Fatuma Tasila is a Pan-African dance instructor who empowers women through music, dance, and spirituality. Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Helen Gurley Brown takes Cosmopolitan magazine, turns it around, makes millions for Hearst Publishing, and yet...
We love you, but I have to tell you, you can't come to the big Hearst anniversary party because women aren't allowed. It was that way.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, thus, as it ever was, the unlikely triumph of Helen Gurley Brown, a new biography next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Welcome back. Well, where would the world of literature be without the masterpiece by Thomas Wolfe, Look Homeward, Angel, or the works of Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and so many more? Those great American titles came to the page through the work of the genius editor Maxwell Perkins. Now, Perkins is played by the actor Colin Firth in the new film Genius. Here's Firth and actor Jude Law, who portrays Thomas Wolfe.
Every word matters.
No, it doesn't.
They're vital.
Nonsense.
Vital.
You're losing the plot. He's falling in love.
What was it like the first time you fell in love, Tom? Was it cornstalk yellow and pompous Chesterfield?
It was a lightning bolt.
And that's what it should be. A lightning bolt. Save all the thunder.
I got you. I got you. Cut that. Cut that. All right. We cut the textile. He saw a woman, cut, cut, cut. But it was her eyes that stopped his breath in his throat that made his heart leap up.
Now, cut the words, Wordsworth.
It stopped his breath
blue they
that
were.
That got the marine
a
line.
Blue beyond blue like the ocean.
Cliche.
A blue beyond blue like...
It's like nothing but blue.
A blue he could swim into forever and never miss... cut this.
And pick up with...
Had there ever been such blue? Had there ever been such eyes?
Don't need the rhetorical.
Why?
It's not a lightning bolt, it's a digression.
A blue beyond blue. No. Her eyes were blue.
Better.
In today's First Coast Connect Book Club, Stacey Goldring here now with a look at Perkins' incredible literary legacy. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Melissa?
I'm well. And, you know, any author can use a good editor, but these guys had probably the best of all time.
They
were lucky, weren't they?
Yeah, they had the author's editor. That's how Maxwell Perkins is known, as the author's editor. And that's very special because that means he's the advocate.
For people who aren't familiar with Perkins, let's talk a little bit about him and the titles that he brought to publication and the authors that he
Absolutely.
Worked with.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's really important because I believe probably every listener this morning has been touched by the brilliance of Perkins. They just didn't know it, so that's what we're going to reveal today. He saw talents and strengths in writers who were unaware of their talents and strengths. He's a Harvard boy. He graduated from Harvard with a degree in economics. So everyone out there, all you aspiring writers who are accountants and engineers, you keep writing and you keep at it. You know, I have a few writers' workshops in Jacksonville, and none of the people in my workshops by day are writers.
Uh-huh.
So everyone has that inner writer in them. So I encourage you, like Perkins, please keep writing. And put yourself out there. So he was he graduated from Harvard, and he got
Harvard.
But he is a Jersey boy. Let's make that perfectly clear. He's born in Jersey, and he was a reporter for the New York Times, and then he joined Scribner's. And at the time, this was 1910, Charles Scribner's and Sons was known for heavyweights like Edith Wharton and Henry James, but Perkins wanted new blood. He wanted new writers, and his first big find was Fitzgerald.
And you brought a little Great Gatsby totem with you here. We'll get that on camera later today.
Many totems. So he signed F. Scott Fitzgerald, who we all know was a very difficult, unfortunately, he suffered from alcoholism, and he wasn't an easy person to be around. He was going into debt all the time. He lived a reckless life with Zelda. They just partied all the time. And no one believed in his work. His first work that Maxwell Perkins brought to Scribner's, they rejected. It was called The Romantic Egotist. But Perkins kept at it. He kept massaging and editing, and he worked on the manuscript with Fitzgerald, and he kept bothering and wearing down Scribner's. So Scribner's evidently said, fine, go ahead and print it, and that became This Side of Paradise.
That was his first published book.
Yeah, and I would say that it's a bit scattered, but it's a very early work, so I suggest reading it if you have not read it. He also, Perkins bailed him out of trouble emotionally. He was like a father figure and really fostered his writing, and that is so important because without Perkins' magic touch, we would not have had The Great Gatsby, which came out in 1925. Can you imagine that going to a bookshelf and not seeing that book? He was responsible for, first of all, what are some little tidbits so you can do trivia?
Okay.
So he wanted to name a book Fitzgerald, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Someone please correct me. Trimalikai, which means try king, and it's from the Greek, a Greek story about a man who lives very recklessly, like Gatsby. And Perkins was like, no, that's not going to happen.
Not so much.
No,
let's
and
go
he
with
said,
something.
What about Great Gatsby? And Zelda said, what about Great Gatsby? And he was like, no, how about the old hatted Gatsby? And Perkins went, no, I don't.
That's why
idea.
We all need an editor in life.
Yeah,
isn't that
the
truth?
Yeah, absolutely. So editing and writing is a collaboration. Well, you know that. So then he said, how about Under the Red, White, and Blue? And Perkins said, guess what? It already went to press. And he and Zelda won out, and it became The Great Gatsby.
And the rest is literary history.
Right, because without Perkins, Tom and Gatsby's fight would have been much more even. Remember the fight scene?
Uh-huh.
Because really, Tom is, you know, he beats the... Well, I'm not going to give it away, but
and for some people that are maybe younger listeners, that was the part played by Tobey Maguire in the film.
Right. There you go. And Gatsby's demise and his failures at the end of the novel, which I will not divulge, but they're you see it coming the whole time. They would have differed a lot because the drafts are out there of the pre-Great Gatsby. So thanks to Perkins, we have a beautifully told story. Now, through Fitzgerald, Perkins met Hemingway, and he was responsible for publishing Hemingway's first major novel, The Sun Also Rises, in 1926. And he fought for keeping in all the profanity because Hemingway's books always were being censored, etc. And Perkins was like, nope, you know, it comes as is. So once Farewell to Arms was published in 1929, that was it. Now we have the author, okay? But his greatest challenge was Thomas Wolfe.
And why is that?
Because Thomas Wolfe was a hot mess. This man...
I think all these guys were, frankly.
Well, you know, gotta be a little crazy. Yeah. But he was married to every word and sentence he wrote. Maxwell Perkins had to cut anywhere, depending on your source, 80 to 90,000 words from the original manuscript of Look Homeward, Angel. That's how many he had to cut. And you can still find that book, although it's out of print. It's called Oh Lost, the Complete Look Homeward, Angel. And that's why when Sean played the clip from the film where he's cutting words, it's killing me, you know, because you are so married to it. And you need someone you can trust that will say to you, you know what, don't need it, doesn't work. Let's clarify it. And that's what I mean by writing is a collaboration. And also, Wolf, you know, like I said, a little crazy, and they had a very tumultuous relationship as editor and writer, and eventually Wolf and Perkins parted ways. However, after Wolf's death, Perkins was his literary executor. So, you know,
he wore a lot of hats in his role, didn't he?
He really did. And I want you to know that I occasionally make pilgrimages or I make hajjs to authors that I truly admire. And I was just in Asheville at Dixieland. That is the home where Look Homeward, Angel takes place. And Melissa, I brought you something.
Really?
And I want to read it to you. It's a little bookmark.
Oh, very nice.
And there's a quote on here that I think with election season, you know, upon us and you being so on the pulse in the community, I thought this is perfect for you. So I'm going to read the quote. This is Wolf. I believe that we are lost here in America, but I believe we shall be found. And this belief is for me, and I think for all of us, not only our own hope, but America's everlasting living dream. You know, I almost, I'm hoping and I'm thinking that Maxwell Perkins' hand was in this. I mean, the construction, it's so beautiful and it's relevant.
Even today.
So that's for you.
Oh, thank you.
I know, that's very exciting. Now,
that is wonderful.
In addition to those three major authors, Perkins was the editor for Marjorie Keenan Rawlings. He was responsible.
Florida's own.
Yeah, for encouraging her to write The Yearling. Alan Paton, who wrote Cry, The Beloved Country, on every reading list that you can imagine.
And many others.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. So you're going to now challenge our virtual book club out there in listener land.
I am.
To go to the public library branch of their choice mm-hmm. and check out any book that was edited by the late, great Maxwell Perkins.
Right. And I have a complete list of authors on the library's blog, so you can check it out there. So remember him as a coach, advocate, and friend. There's a great bio out by him called Max Perkin, Editor of Genius, and that's what the film was based on. That's by A. Scott Berg, and the library has a copy. So,
and you have some emails from our book club today, right?
I do, yeah. I have. I only have two that we have time for today, but I wanted to remember when we spoke about dialect. Got a lot of responses from people. Dialect really moves people. They really get on the train and they ride it when it's authentic. And so in this case, Trevor wrote in recommending a poem. And we've not worked with poetry on this program, but Eventually we will, when I feel brave enough to go there. But he recommends a poem called My Island, Jamaica, and it's something that spoke to him, and he says the dialect is handled beautifully. I read it, and it's a beautiful poem. So you can just Google My Island, Jamaica. It's a stunning poem, and thank you to Trevor. And lastly, I want to thank Randall, and I can't believe I forgot to bring this up. You know how we love to make up words on this show.
You've coined quite a few new words, yeah.
So Randall brought up Jonathan Swift, who did so many words, created so many words. And from Gulliver's Travels, Randall mentions the word unflappable, which Swift coined, which in the book itself was what everyone had to do. They had to flap their arms in order to get people's attention. So if you're unflappable, that meant that we all know now that, you know, you and I are unflappable. Nothing surprises us.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far.
But
at a certain point, you do sort of get to almost that position
it's
in
called,
life.
It's called wisdom. It's called wisdom.
Well, as always, it is an incredible treat to speak to you, and anyone can connect with Stacy with your ideas and reactions to the book club here on the show. Just email us, her and me, and Sean Birch, at bookclub@wjct.org. We want your feedback on our monthly book club. And again, as Stacy mentioned, our partner in the First Coast Connect Book Club is the Jacksonville Public Library. Look for the title Stacy recommends at your library branch. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Jessie Klein. She's the head writer for Inside Amy Schumer. She has a new collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It, in which she writes about her experiences dating, getting married, having a child, and breaking into comedy, and doing it all while being what she describes as a Tom man, a woman who never outgrew dressing like a tomboy. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Who is your American graduate champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American graduate champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American graduate champion today.
Coming up on The Next Reveal, what makes a good Border Patrol agent go bad?
It's a slow, painful process, but it is a process.
We learn how one former agent became corrupt and a shocking case of an agent accused of murder.
This cartel pistol with the bad guy's name on it shouldn't be with the badge of a Border Patrolman.
On The Next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Jackie Carter, Executive Secretary for Duval County's Emergency Operations Center. Have a plan for home, work, and school. Planning can save you valuable time and money in a disaster. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Well, welcome back. Well, finally this hour, almost every kid has that uncontrollable desire to draw on the wall. I know my kids do. Well, it turns out Ethan Murrow never lost that fascination, and his work seeks to elevate drawing and connect the art form to the practice we all learned in our youth, much to our parents' dismay. This July, the Boston-based artist takes his photorealistic drawing practice to the Museum of Contemporary Art Jacksonville, and his project Plethora is being done with 800 black Sharpies. Now, even cooler, you can come watch the artist at work this month. Ethan Murrow, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
This is called Plethora, and you're doing this with black Sharpies. Is that right?
Yes, and it's not just me. There's a team of five of us. So I'm working with three Jacksonville-based artists. which has been fantastic, and then one artist from New York. And we are working nonstop through July 15th. Our target finish date is the 15th at around 2 p.m., so we have a tight deadline. Uh-huh. We scribble and scratch away on the wall as fast as we can, and we're trying to build a big, grand drawing that will welcome people into the museum.
And if people wander into MoCA this week, they can watch you and that team
Absolutely.
Up there on the wall drawing away.
Absolutely. And while it grows slowly, if you can step in for 15 minutes one day and then come back the next, you know, hopefully you'll see a big transition.
Tell us about the theme of this exhibit. It sounds really interesting. Tell us what you're trying to communicate.
Well, one thing that was clear to me when I came, I was lucky enough to be able to come to the museum in March, I believe, to look at the site and think about the project. And it was clear to me, for those that have been to MoCA, it's three levels of galleries, and then the atrium is this big, vast space in the middle. And the galleries that surround the atrium and look out on it reminded me of the balconies of a theater. So it kind of looked like an opera house or... and the wall that I'm working on kind of reminded me of a proscenium or the stage. And so I wanted to create a piece that reflected that drama of the space. So mm-hmm. the drawing depicts a figure in front of this massive table of food. And this is an abundance of food, too much food for one person. And so the premise of the drawing is that this figure is a figure of privilege. They've protected all this food for themselves. So we're trying to create a situation where maybe the viewers will come in and wonder about that privilege, that access, that plethora of food, and think about who that figure might be and what they're doing.
Who is that figure in your mind? Who is it really?
It is me.
It's you.
Yeah, so one of the ways we develop a drawing like this is I worked with photographers in Boston, laid out a huge mass of melons and beans and strawberries and some food items that are native to this part of the world. And we shot the scene in Boston, and then working with the museum, developed the resources that seemed appropriate for the wall. And then we worked back and forth from the photographs to develop the drawing. And I wanted to be in the drawing because I'm trying to have a conversation about access to food and this discussion of privilege. And I want to recognize that I'm part of the problem. I want to implicate myself in that.
As a white male, as a middle-class American, or all
Absolutely.
Of the above?
Absolutely, all of the above. And I feel like food is something that touches all of us. And certainly there are, you know, the majority of the United States does not have great access to food or access of any kind at all. And I think it's very easy to overlook that if you are a person of privilege, if you are middle class or upper middle class, and you have a good grocery store nearby. And then there are so many communities that don't have that at all. So
yeah.
I'm trying to not necessarily say that I have the solutions, because I certainly don't, but raise some questions with the drawing and set up a scenario where viewers might come in and start to think about their own relationship to food.
Interesting. Because, yes, we have this weird dichotomy in this country where a lot of people are overweight. And that includes poor people that are food insecure.
Absolutely.
Because right here in Jacksonville, they live in what are called food deserts, where they don't have a grocery store for miles around. They might not have a car to drive to one, and they don't have access to healthy produce.
Right.
And so you're taking this really serious subject, but you're conveying it in this way that kind of harkens back to our childhood. You're drawing on the wall with a magic marker, a bunch of magic markers.
Yeah. I mean, the film also is a bit of an homage to Charlie Chaplin. There's a moment in the drawing where a pot has come and fallen down on the main figure, the protagonist's head. And I'm trying to set up a scene of kind of tomfoolery or absurdity there. And part of what I guess, trying to talk about in that moment is the way in which, while these tough subjects, they're really overwhelming and difficult and perturbing, it's also really good to think about all the different ways we can emotionally react to and respond to these difficult situations. And I think Chaplin, to me, was a perfect example of the way in which you can look at humans as idiots or bumbling fools and still appreciate the fact that within those moments of failure or stumbling, we can kind of recognize what's good in humanity and gain something from that. So I think we're at our best when we recognize our own failures. So I'm trying to pay homage to those early moments of silent film and slapstick, which I think, while they're in a way dumb in their in the physical movement that figures might be involved in, they also tell us a little bit of something about ourselves.
Well, this is certainly the latest in a wonderful tradition of provocative exhibits in the Project Daydream series at MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art, Jacksonville. Your piece officially opens July 16th, but as we said, you can come and watch the artist at work right now. Ethan Murrow and his team are constructing this exhibit on the atrium wall of MoCA as we speak, so just come on by any time between now and the 15th and watch this being created. Ethan Murrow, a pleasure. So nice to meet you, and thanks for sharing this with us.
Thanks for having me.
And go to mocajacksonville.org for more information about Project Atrium. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show, Video on Demand, with our partner TVJax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, President Obama and former President Bush go to Dallas to call for healing. Presidential candidates offer reactions as well. Coming up, political leadership in a time of deep national divisions. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.